welcome to Sojourner Truth. Thank you for staying with us. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Tuesday's election results have boosted hope for progressives that the tide is turning away from Trumpism. Democrats took the governorships in Virginia and New Jersey, and several transgender candidates won seats. In Virginia, Annika Rome is set to become the first openly transgender person elected to a state legislature, and in Minneapolis, two Black transgender representatives were elected to city council. Among the wave of progressives getting elected on Tuesday, we today are going to focus on the contentious race for district attorney in Philadelphia. Civil rights advocate and anti-death penalty proponent Larry Krasner overwhelmingly won his race as the new DA in Philadelphia. Krasner considers himself a movement lawyer who supports criminal justice reform, opposes Trump's moves against immigrants, and calls for an end to mass incarceration. What happened in Philadelphia? Are we seeing an uptick of progressive DAs in other cities across the U.S.? Is this an example that sticking to one's progressive principles can mean victory? What role did grassroots movements play in Krasner's election, and how was a broader electorate convinced enough that Krasner defeated his GOP opponent with a whopping 75% of the vote? Our guest is Carol Rosenthal, who was a neighborhood engagement coordinator with the Krasner campaign. And for our weekly Earth Watch, we return to our coverage of Puerto Rico, where the majority of residents are still facing an unprecedented humanitarian disaster in that island in the wake of Hurricane Maria. And the double standard response to the hurricane in Puerto Rico by the Trump administration. Increasing numbers of residents have become environmental refugees fleeing the island, and it has just been announced that FEMA will help to transport refugees from Puerto Rico to the mainland in the United States. Our guest is Desiree Lynn, founder of the refugee solidarity group Love Has No Borders. And as the new Poor People's Campaign is on the rise in the U.S., we're taking a look at the hidden poor. People, because they have a quote-unquote professional job, are therefore not seen as poor. Even as universities raise tuitions and rake in millions, the army of postdocs and research assistants who contribute to the work and prestige of the university are undervalued and underpaid. And at the University of Washington, there is a move to unionize by postdocs, a move being undermined by the administration of that university. Our guest is Max Friedfeld, a research associate in the Department of Chemistry at the University of Washington and a member of the University of Washington Postdocs United. We live in a global world. We're all interrelated. So on Sojourner Truth, we work to bring directly to you news and views on local, national, and international policies and stories that affect us all. And we draw out how those of us most impacted, women, communities of color, and other communities are responding. We also discuss the interrelationship between art and politics. Now for our news headlines.
For Pacifica Radio, I'm Eileen Alfandary. President Donald Trump sought to present a united front with Chinese President Xi Jinping following 2 days of meetings, despite lingering differences over trade and North Korea. On trade, Trump said China had taken advantage of the U.S. in the past, but he doesn't blame the country for that.
And I have great respect for you for that, because you're representing China. But it's too bad that past administrations allowed it to get so far out of kilter.
During the presidential campaign, Trump accused China of raping the U.S. on trade. Republicans are speeding ahead with their tax overhaul legislation. The Tax Writing House Ways and Means Committee plans to vote on its legislation today, sending it to the full House. In the Senate, Finance Committee Chair Orrin Hatch plans to unveil his chamber's tax legislation. Reportedly, it contains billions in tax cuts for people and corporations, repeal of the federal deduction for state and local taxes, and a likely compression of the personal income tax brackets from 7 to 4. This week's Republican losses at the polls gave urgency to the measure. House Speaker Paul Ryan noted that the sobering election results just puts more pressure on making sure they follow through on the party's drive to overhaul the tax code. Senate Democratic Minority Leader Chuck Schumer said if Republicans press ahead, they will compound their political problems, especially in middle-class suburban areas, which will feel the brunt of the elimination of the state and local tax deduction.
You're going to kill suburban legislators who are already in trouble because the suburbs don't seem to like Donald Trump. So we say to our Republican friends on this tax bill, as Clint Eastwood said, you want to pass this tax bill? You want to hurt the suburbs? Make our day.
The three richest people in the U.S. now own more wealth than the bottom 50% of the U.S. population. That's according to a new report released by the Institute for Policy Studies. The report, Billionaire Bonanza, also finds that the 400 richest individuals now own more wealth than the bottom 64% of the population, while pervasive poverty means 1 in 5 households have zero or negative net worth. The report's authors write the U.S. is becoming a hereditary aristocracy of wealth and power. Texas Democrat Al Green vows he'll force a House vote on the impeachment of Donald Trump before Christmas. Green unveiled formal articles of impeachment last month. He didn't say how he planned to force a vote, but could invoke rules allowing what's known as a privileged resolution within 2 days after giving notice.
There will be a vote on the chief inciter of racism, bigotry, hatred, xenophobia, sexism, ethnocentrism. There will be a vote in the U.S. House of Representatives, Mr. Speaker, on the impeachment of the president. And while I have been told that there are political consequences for what I will do, I accept the consequences. I accept the consequences because I was not born in Congress. I wasn't born to be a congressman.
House Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi recently said even if Democrats were to retake control of the House in the 2018 elections, impeaching Donald Trump would not be one of their priorities. The United Nations and more than 20 aid groups are warning that the Saudi-led coalition's tightening of a blockade on war-torn Yemen could bring millions of people closer to starvation and death. United Nations Humanitarian Chief Mark Lowcock said unless the coalition lifts its blockade, Yemen will face the largest famine the world has seen for decades.
It will not be like the famine that we saw in South Sudan earlier in the year, where tens of thousands of people were affected. It will not be like the famine which cost 250,000 people their lives in Somalia in 2011. It will be the largest famine the world has seen for many decades, with millions of victims.
The Saudi-led coalition closed all ports and halted aid shipments after Yemen's Houthi rebels fired a ballistic missile over the weekend that was intercepted over Riyadh. The United States provides weapons to Saudi Arabia and in-air refueling for its warplanes carrying out bombing raids over Yemen. I'm Eileen Alfandari. You're listening to Sojourner Truth on Pacifica Radio.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. This past Tuesday was Election Day, and it was a good day for Democrats as a whole, who won both the New Jersey and Virginia governor's race. Virginia also saw Danica Rome become the first openly transgender woman to win a seat in the state legislature. She beat out Bob Marshall, the transphobic Republican politician who introduced the state's notorious bathroom bill. Andrea Jenkins became the first openly transgender Black woman elected to public office in the U.S. and now sits on the Minneapolis City Council. And Ravi Bala became New Jersey's first Sikh mayor in Hoboken, New Jersey. And for our topic today, in Philadelphia, Larry Krasner was overwhelmingly elected the city's new district attorney. Krasner is a civil rights lawyer who has sued the Philadelphia Police Department dozens of times and represented Black Lives Matter, Occupy Philly, and protesters at the Republican National Convention. He's never worked as a prosecutor, and as district attorney, he has promised to never pursue the death penalty, put an end to cash bail, treat addiction as a medical problem, not a crime, stand up to police misconduct, end illegal stop and frisk, expand victim services programs, and keep Philadelphia as a sanctuary city. He ran against Beth Grossman, who was endorsed by law enforcement and served for 2 decades as an assistant district attorney. She was the Republican candidate. And by the latest count, Krasner won 74.6% of the votes, nearly 3 in 4, while Grossman took in 25.3%. Now, there was a swell of support behind Krasner, and that support is being seen as a rebuttal to U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions' reinvigoration of the war on drug policies at the national level. While Sessions is reinstating mandatory minimum sentences, Larry Krasner has pledged to end mass incarceration and put an end to drug war policies. His election could signal big change for the city of Philadelphia, a city that has the highest per capita incarceration rate of 10 largest cities in the United States, this according to the Philadelphia Inquirer. Let us go now to hear from Larry Krasner himself, from part of the victory speech that he gave after his election. The source is Newsworks.
Story about the history of kings and queens. This is a story about a movement.
That's right, sir.
And this is a movement that is tired of seeing a system that is systematically picked on poor people, primarily Black and brown. This is a mandate for a movement that is loudly telling government what it wants. And what it wants is criminal justice reform in ways that require transformational change within the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office. This is a movement that says we are not just voters. We are the bosses who pay the taxes. The salaries of the city workers. And we have every right to expect that we will get what we just told you we want, which is transformational change in criminal justice and in this district attorney's office. So how are we going to do that? Well, I'll tell you how we're going to do that. And we are going to do that. The way we are going to do that starts with election. We've done that.
Yeah.
It's not me, it's we. And then it goes to transition. If you, or anyone who knows, you know, shares these values, shares this desire for things to get better, for people not to be divided, for society to heal, to reconcile and bring things together. If you, like us, believe it's time to end the death penalty, if you believe it's time to end mass incarceration, if you believe it's time to stop making prisoners for poor people by using cash bail. If you are sick and tired scare of government stealing grandma's house when she didn't do anything wrong. And if you have no intention of helping Trump's immigration agenda.
Alrighty, and there you heard a very enthusiastic crowd with Larry Krasner speaking to his supporters after his victory. And I'd like to welcome Carol Rosenthal. She is a neighborhood engagement coordinator with the Krasner campaign. Carol, thank you for joining us.
So nice to be here, Margaret.
I know you must be so excited. And from what I understand, there was a huge turnout, 69% higher than 2013 and the highest turnout in 20 years. And this in the middle of bad weather, millennials flooded out to the polls. What happened? How did you all do it?
Carol. Well, I think there are two key ingredients that went into creating such an enormous turnout. One is Larry's message and his platform, and the other is that we had an incredibly well-organized ground game and a swell of volunteers.
Right. And tell us really the who, I mean, he got practically 75% of the vote, a little underneath that. Who were his supporters? Who turned out?
Well, we don't have all of the breakdowns quite yet. However, we do know that people who turned out, number one, are millennials. We do know there are people who turned out because they wanted to find a concrete local way to resist the Trump agenda that would have tangible effects. And people who turned out are also very likely people who understand that mass incarceration in Philadelphia is a major impact, not just as a human rights issue, but also as an economic issue, an education issue. And that the city really can't afford to continue forward the way that we have.
Right. And, you know, there was some concern because the Fraternal Order of Police, who is so feared, particularly in elections for DAs across the country. I mean, they're feared like people fear the NRA, right? And that you really can't go against the Fraternal Order of Police. But they endorsed Grossman, the GOP opposition to Krasner, and she came in with something like what? 25% of the vote. You know, tell us a bit about that and also about the concerns for some white bleed of police officers who were Democrats but may have crossed over to vote for Grossman in this election.
Sure. I think it's really important to remember that the FOP is the police union and it's not the actual police department. So there are definitely members of the police department that supported Larry, such as the Guardian Civic League, which is the organization that represents black police officers here in Philadelphia, and that Larry has a very good relationship with the police commissioner here. So there is a difference between the FOP and the department itself. And frankly, I personally would have been pretty surprised if the FOP had endorsed Larry. Larry has a long history of holding police accountable for abuse and misconduct and doing that through the court system. And it's something that, frankly, people crave and want to see more of in the district attorney's office. Because we know that the abuse and corruption happens when there are some bad apples and that it ruins the relationships between communities and the very good police officers, of which they are by far the majority, and that we need an office that's going to hold the police accountable so that we can move forward and improve community relationships.
Well, let me ask you this, though, Carol, because we hear the bad apple argument quite a lot when it comes to policing. The movement for Black Lives, they object to some of that because, of course, not all police officers go out and beat, as 26 police officers did in Philadelphia, 22-year-old Tyree Carroll for no good reason, or shoot and kill unarmed Black people. But there is institutional racism that I think Larry has spoken about. So to just say it's a few bad apples really undermines the systemic or sidelines the systemic racism that Black communities who came out in force, from what I understand, voting for Krasner, that they're complaining about.
Absolutely. I mean, systemic racism in the police department is obviously something that will be tackled through Larry's work in the district attorney's office, and is why so many people of color supported and came out in force for Larry. However, I do think that, you know, there are people who voted for Larry who might not come from those communities, for whom systemic racism is not a daily experience of theirs, and we're still...
So why did they vote for Larry?
I think they are still very much in favor and understanding of the fact that even if the FOP doesn't endorse, it doesn't mean that there aren't police that are on Larry's side and on the side of justice. And I think that there are a lot of his issues that they stand behind as well. And when you look at the issue of public education in Philadelphia, as is true in many cities around the country, we are not able to adequately fund our schools, and part of that is because we're spending $40,000 a year on people in prison per person.
Yeah.
So I think that there are a lot of people who understand the economics of what that means, and that we're putting our money into putting every time we put somebody in prison who does not need to be there, we're taking away a guidance counselor. We're taking away a teacher from their child's school. We are taking away a school nurse. We are taking away the ability to have books in libraries and schools.
Yeah.
And so I think that that's a message that's very understandable to many people.
Right. And so, because I'm looking at a quote here from Larry Krasner when he announced his run for the DA. This was in Philadelphia Magazine. He said, "We have the highest percentage of incarcerated people of the nations in the world. We have more men of color in prison, jail, or probation or parole than when we're in slavery at the start of the Civil War. Are we safe? The answer, we are not." And of course, he's using the statistic from Michelle Alexander's The New Jim Crow. The other thing I wanted to ask you about, just in terms of your role with the neighborhood engagement coordination with the Krasner campaign, is the listening sessions that I think you helped to organize in communities. I know one that happened at the Crossroads Women's Center. They've never had such a thing before, right? Of somebody who was running for elected office, and very much a lot of impoverished and grassroots women. Krasner turned up and spent time with them answering questions. Tell us about that.
Sure. So a lot of campaigns talk about voter engagement, and there's a difference between voters who are registered and voters who go to the poll. Voter registration in Philadelphia is not as much of a problem as actually voter engagement and getting those registered voters to show up at the poll. And so I personally feel that we need to flip that conversation and not talk as much about voter engagement, but talk about candidate engagement in those communities where voters are not necessarily showing up at the polls. And in Philadelphia, those happen to be neighborhoods of poverty. Those happen to be neighborhoods with high concentrations of people of color and high concentrations of people who have contact with the district attorney's office and with the criminal justice system. For us, it was not just a calculus about let's go where the votes are, But for us, it was about how do we learn from communities that are most impacted by the criminal justice system about the changes that need to be made. And the listening session that you're referring to is one that we had focused on women, poverty, and incarceration. It is a powerful thing to go into a community with a candidate, not to just handshake, but to have lengthy conversations and be willing to stay as long as it takes at an event to speak to every single person who is lined up in a long line behind a microphone, asking questions, engaging in issues that directly impact their families and neighborhood.
That is absolutely amazing. I mean, it is a kind of a bottom-up approach as opposed to top-down. We usually see those in money really controlling it. And I'm wondering, I mean, putting Larry Krasner's win within the broader context, we see that Bernie Sanders, our revolution nationally, they won 21 seats. Larry, in the clip that we played, talked about progressive DAs increasingly in Brooklyn, Chicago, and other places. And in, I wonder, in other major cities, including in Los Angeles, where the district attorney there, Jackie Lacey, has long been criticized by Black Lives Matter. And one has to wonder that likely DAs like Jackie Lacey and others are looking at what happened with Larry Krasner in Philadelphia, where it seems as though he stuck to his progressive principles and that kind of bottom-up approach. And it worked remarkably with a whopping 75% of the vote. So just final comments from you in terms of lessons that can be learned from Larry's campaign and election.
Sure. I mean, I think it is a convergence of a lot of different factors. One is that Larry is a candidate who walks the walk and that you could look at the 30-year history of his career and know that he's not just pulling out a progressive line because we need to resist Trump. This is who he is to his core, and it is the work that he has done. So I think it is important that you have the right candidate running for these district attorney offices, and also that you do incorporate the grassroots constituencies, the issues that matter to them. And we have had a very robust dialogue with a group here called the Coalition for a Just DA. It's comprised of, I think at this point, almost 30 different organizations, many of them grassroots organizations. So that is not just the candidate setting the agenda, but it is the people saying, this is what matters to us. We're not just going to hold you accountable if you're elected, but we're also going to hold you accountable as a candidate.
Right.
And we're going to hold you accountable to creating a platform that represents the community's needs.
Coalition for a Just DA. I think everybody listening, wherever this show is heard, I'm sure is taking note of that, because the whole issue of mass incarceration, policing, et cetera, so much gets to the heart of the day to day things that communities of color and other low income communities are dealing with. But finally, Carol, looking at an article in The Atlantic where they talked about some rumors that there are a number of assistant DAs that are opposed to Larry and may walk out or may leave if he wins. How concerned, as far as you know, I don't know if you do, is the Krasner campaign about this? And are there other who can kind of step in if those others leave?
Yeah, I mean, we're really not concerned about this, because in that office, there has to be a good match between the assistant district attorneys and Larry. And so if there are people working there now who feel that that's not a good match for them, then it's appropriate for them to find another place of employment. And we have had such a tremendous national groundswell of support around his candidacy and around his win that we know we are going to be getting many job applications from outside the city as well, and have already launched a website, which is KrasnerTransition.com, where people can upload their resumes and cover letters. I think it's very exciting to many young people who are coming out of law school and who are interested in working for justice, and to have an option that's not only going to work for the public defender, but how can we bring justice into the prosecutorial side of things as well?
Right. Trasner.
So I think we're going to have a lot of really great viable candidates if we end up seeing some folks leave the current.
I'm sure. We're going to post this actually on our social media, KrasnerTransition.com. We are going to have to leave it there, but congratulations to Larry Krasner. We've been following his campaign very, very closely, and we want to thank you, Carol Rosenthal, for joining us. Thank you
Absolutely.
So very much.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and we also want to thank Phoebe Jones Schellenberg, who is a coordinator of the Crossroads Women's Center, for her help with this particular segment. We are going to take a short station break, and coming up, we return to our coverage of the humanitarian crisis in Puerto Rico, and then we're going to go to a story, a little reported story about union efforts, postdocs, and research assistants. Stay with us. We'll be right back. And the great Earth, Wind, and Fire, and the song That's the Way of the World. This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. If you've missed any part of this hour, for 90 days after that, just go to kpfk.org, scroll down to archives, click on Sojourner Truth. You'll be able to hear the show in its entirety. And you know what? You can subscribe for a free podcast. And we would also like to welcome our SoundCloud listeners. Just go to SoundCloud and look for Sojourner Truth with Margaret Prescott. And you can check us out on our website at www.sotrueradio.org. And if you're a member of Facebook, you can like and friend us on Facebook. On both Facebook and our website, you can also get the archives of our back shows. So we invite you to do that. And today we want to give a shout out to our SoundCloud listeners in the great city of Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. And we are now going to turn our attention to what is happening on the ground in Puerto Rico. Natalie Jaresco, Executive Director of the Financial Oversight and Management Board for Puerto Rico, spoke to Congress on Tuesday, asking them to help with housing, water, and power on the island after Hurricane Maria. She said, quote, without unprecedented levels of help from the United States government, the recovery we were planning for will fail. And of course, we have to keep in mind that people living in Puerto Rico are U.S. citizens. At current count, at least 51 people have died directly from Hurricane Maria in Puerto Rico, likely many more when you take into account those who are dying from lack of medicine, electricity, as well as for diseases bound to happen given the humanitarian disaster. Puerto Rican authorities estimate the damage will cost the island between $45 and $95 billion. But Congress has only approved $5 billion thus far. According to Reuters, as many as 10,000 Puerto Ricans have left the region for the mainland U.S., basically becoming environmental refugees. And on Thursday, FEMA said it would be transporting survivors from Puerto Rico to the mainland U.S., giving priority to the 3,000 people who are in shelters. And again, we have to remember these are environmental refugees. A study by the Center for Puerto Rican Studies at Hunter College in New York estimates that 114,000 to 213,000 Puerto Rico residents residents will leave the country, resulting in a 14% decrease in population by 2019. Less than half of Puerto Rico has electricity, and still many without running water, thousands still without running water. What we're going to do now is go to a short clip from ABC on the situation on the ground.
She's saying after the hurricane, there's no way she can live here. I mean, if you look, the roof is on the floor. This is her second bedroom. And nothing that's inside now works. Everything is destroyed now. Totally ruined.
This is the home of 65-year-old Blanca Altagracia Gomez, who lived in a modest but beautiful home with air conditioning and modern conveniences until Hurricane Maria hit.
So now this is the upstairs part of the home, and you can see the FEMA tarps are across all the roofs. They have placed a tarp on top of the roof, but when it rains, the rain still comes inside. At night, this is where she sleeps. They have a mosquito net over their bed because everything is wet. FEMA sent her a letter, basically, which says that they've reviewed everything and she's eligible for $500. ¿Qué puedes hacer con eso?
No sé.
She says she doesn't know what she would do with $500. She says she doesn't have family that can lend her money. Even if she borrowed money, she can't pay it back. What is she going to do?
Driving deeper into the island, there were signs of the hurricane's destruction everywhere. But we also saw signs of determination and ingenuity.
Oh, look at this. So we are approaching what looks like a place where people are getting water from the mountain. Look at that. That is very resourceful.
Jose Gonzalez
is saying there's a gentleman that the first day after the hurricane put this up so that the town, the people of Puerto Rico, could have fresh water. People are taking it, they're boiling it, and then they're able to use it. And they're indebted to him. But this is, again, the resilience of Puerto Rico.
I'd now like to welcome Desiree Lynn. Desiree is a Tampa, Florida-based social climate and economic justice organizer. She founded the refugee solidarity group Love Has No Borders and is an active longtime member of Food Not Bombs Tampa. She's done disaster relief work in New Orleans, St. Augustine, West Virginia, as well as across Florida post-Hurricane Irma. She recently returned from Puerto Rico, where she delivered medical and food aid with a grassroots network called Mutual Aid Disaster Relief post-Hurricane Maria. And she's preparing to go on a three-month tour with that organization. Desiree, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Desiree, I see from your bio that you have been doing this kind of humanitarian work for several years, traveling to Palestine, going to Lebanon, and other places, and you consider yourself, you say you're an anarchist and a vocal anti-fascist. But Desiree, tell us about your impressions of what it was like on the ground in Puerto Rico.
Absolutely. I just want to mention something in the story that you played, the clip of the family who had the tarps over their roof from FEMA and who were very sadly given a check for $500 from FEMA. Mm-hmm. That's terrible, and it's an example of FEMA's failure, but that's a standout moment because most people have not even heard from FEMA, and many people in the rural municipalities don't have roofs anymore and there are no tarps. So the rain is just freely coming into their houses and they're sweeping it out. This is a result of FEMA's bottlenecking resources and wasting the people powered resources that they have on the ground. But the things that I saw while I was there were massive public safety issues, roads where there were walls from the side of the highway that were collapsed fully into a lane of the highway, didn't even have a single cone around them, a truck or anything diverting or warning people to get out of that lane. Likewise, with hundreds of trees and debris and street lines and light poles that are down in the streets. There's not even a basic visible sign of concern for public safety and for harm reduction going forward for people that are having to exist within this space post Hurricane Maria. We also visited with anti-colonialist, anti-racist communities that were gathering on a mountain summit in Humacao, where they had waited for government and FEMA assistance to arrive, which never did. So they organized daily food shares. So they're cooking out of a kitchen that used to be the site of festivals and concerts in their communities. Well, that stage is wrecked now and the roof is off, but they're still cooking every day for the people of that community. So what we've also seen in the context of medical access being and resources being shared with people there were that communities were taking us from house to house where there were elderly people suffering from an exacerbation of chronic conditions like cardiac and respiratory issues that are sweltering in, you know, soaring temperatures right now in Puerto Rico. And we're in living rooms where sweat is dripping off of us and we've just gone in for a few minutes to do a check on someone where they're having to exist in these conditions day in and day out. And one man we even had to transport to the hospital who was critical with chest pains, and FEMA had a tent and were stationed outside of the emergency room and told us, sorry, they're closed and couldn't help him. So we saw a lot of people suffering. We saw a lot of things that would lead us to believe that the number, it's actually set at 55 right now of confirmed deaths in Puerto Rico from Hurricane Maria, is greatly, greatly and tragically underestimated, which cuts the amount of support, the amount of concern, and the amount of activity and resources that are getting to the people. So there was a lot of frustrating instances of seeing federal agents by the thousands occupying a Sheraton, a luxury hotel by the convention center, along with FBI, FEMA workers, other state police from around the U.S. And they're in air conditioning. It was cool in there. It was cold. They had a catered, dedicated buffet. They had Starbucks. They had internet service. They were resting in a room that used to be used as a clinic for people in Puerto Rico immediately after the hurricane was transitioned to a rest area for FEMA workers. So we saw a lot of just instances that were incredibly frustrating where resources weren't being utilized in the way that they needed to be utilized, you know, critically and immediately for the people. And one other thing was the mention of the air bridge, the subsequent mass exodus of these climate refugees that are going to be moved from Puerto Rico to Florida and New York because of what's happening. Well, this mass exodus wouldn't have been necessary. Like FEMA saying they've never taken this step before. Well, they aren't very apt and adept at doing the things that they're supposed to know how to do and provide. So then turning to creating an air bridge to transport climate refugees, well, they weren't, with this drastic steps wouldn't have been necessary if the less drastic steps were taken immediately to preserve life and to reduce harm and reduce suffering for the people in Puerto Rico post-Hurricane Maria.
Right. And of course, I just would like our listeners to know that we are also going to be doing some updates about the non-U.S. territories that were so hard hit, places like Dominica, but even some of the U.S. Territories that are overwhelmingly people of African descent, like in St. Croix and St. John, that were totally, destroyed just about, and we're hearing very, very little. But Desiree Lynn, for people who want to support your efforts, what should they do?
So I think the best way to support is to participate in the effort. Just quickly, our group Mutual Aid Disaster Relief is a decentralized movement. We come from looking at revolutionaries like the Black Panthers and providing survival programs. We're decentralized, autonomous, solidarity, not charity-based relief efforts. And for people who would like to support these efforts, get involved, like see through the rhetoric and propaganda that people like Donald Trump are putting out there and propping up against the ruins of Puerto Rico just to try to not, you know, have the the you know, the legacy of this being Trump's Katrina. You know, we want to, for people to know that our, you know, Mutual Aid Disaster Relief, we are a decentralized movement. People can look at mutualaiddisasterrelief.org and find out, like, our core vision and our mission and our principles, which are viewing disasters through a wider lens and contextualizing environmental racism and concentrated poverty, climate chaos and capitalism exacerbated climate chaos. And viewing these communities that are demonized on a daily basis, communities of color, marginalized, impoverished communities that are now suffering through a disaster. So the disaster didn't begin when the rain started to fall and the wind started to pick up. The disaster began long before that. And, you know, we see it as a long-term effort. We want to...
We understand that, Desiree. We are short of time, though. So give us that website again. Thank you.
Yeah, mutualaiddisasterrelief.org.
Right. Well, we appreciate that. We appreciate you and your work. We want to thank the Global Justice Ecology Project that we partner with for our weekly Earth Watch. And we're going to be continuing our coverage, not only of Puerto Rico, but Dominica and St. Croix and other islands in the Caribbean so hard hit by Hurricane Maria. Desiree Lynn, thank you for joining us. She's with Love Has No Borders. Thank you, Desiree.
Thanks for having me.
This is Margaret Prescott, host of Sojourner Truth. Now, some of you have heard on the airwaves the speech given in Los Angeles by the Reverend William Barber and the growing new Poor People's Campaign that is will be nationally launched on December the 4th and then leading up to mass actions across the nation of this coming spring. And I was recently at a conference in Washington, in Houston, Texas, actually, which was the 40th anniversary of the first and only congressionally mandated conference on women, and where I was a delegate, actually, to that conference from New York State. But one of the discussions we had with some of the young people there were what happens with the graduate students, the postdocs working at these universities, some of them carrying huge workloads. And some of the graduate students were saying that some of them are earning as little as $15,000, maybe $30,000. Okay, that may be more than what a lot of impoverished people are making, but that they're actually some of these graduate students, I mean, with degrees and doctorate degrees, even some of whom have to live on food stamps or support. And there's a lot of embarrassment of people, you know, to even be speaking about that situation, since they're considered professionals and they're also working at prestigious universities. Well, there is an attempt now at the University of Washington to unionize. And while some of them may not fit the description I just gave, certainly it's a population of people that fall under the radar. And I'd like to welcome Max Fridfield, a research associate in the Department of Chemistry at the University of Washington and a member of the University of Washington Postdocs United. Welcome, Max.
Thank you very much, Margaret, for having me.
Okay, so what is going on here with the postdocs? I mean, what pushback are you getting from the University of Washington with your attempts to unionize?
So I want to say that postdocs are people who have completed graduate school, and so they've graduated with usually their PhDs in whichever field they work in. And they are continuing to do research in the academic setting to diversify their skill set and continue collaborations or do more research. And postdocs at the University of Washington have been working to create a union in order to improve their workplace conditions and increase protections for postdoctoral workers for almost a year now is how long the campaign's been going on. And so we're really excited to be able to fight to increase our workplace protections and, you know, stand together with postdocs across the university.
Right. And so you are organizing with UAW Local 4121. But from what I understand, the university is not exactly welcoming this campaign with open arms, and are indeed trying to say that postdocs hired as research associates, acting assistant professors, and acting instructors, which are about 35% of postdocs, should not be included in this union pool. Did I get that right?
Yeah, that's right. And I think it's really important to understand the historical context of union campaigns here at the University of Washington. Over the course of the past 15 or 20 years, the administration has historically been opposed to union formation here on campus. And, you know, this particular campaign is just another example of that. The claim that the university administration is making is that postdocs with different job titles should not be included in the same bargaining unit. And that's a very silly distinction, in my opinion, because the way that the job titles are assigned has no bearing on the kind of work you do. So for example, all postdocs in certain departments are given one job title, and then postdocs in different in other departments are given other job titles, and the the job title is sort of an arbitrary classification, and so the difference is essentially in name only. The work that I do is not that different from the work that someone who's given the job title of a senior fellow is doing in the med school versus in the College of Arts and Sciences. We were hired as postdocs. Faculty know that we're postdocs. Department administration knows we're postdocs. We know we're postdocs. And we think that this is just a way that the administration is trying to divide us and to slow down the unionization campaign. And we don't want that to happen. We're not going to let this, you know, drive a wedge in between postdocs on campus, and we're going to stand together and stand united.
Right. Well, Max, let me ask you this. For people who are listening and saying, well, you know, you guys, you're at a university, you know, you've got a graduate degree, a master's, a PhD, you know, what are you complaining about? What do you need a union for? I mean, what is the benefit of unionization of postdocs for postdocs?
Yeah, that's a really good question, and that's something that that I've struggled with. But in you know, because we are coming from a place of, you know, having attained a high degree and working at a research institution, and I'd say that it's really important to think about, you know, everybody who's doing this kind of work and might not have the same you know, access to rights and benefits that everybody else does. There's a number of people.
Or pay, it seems, you know, to me, also. Yeah, I'm raising this because, as I said, I just came back from this conference, and I was talking and having a discussion with some young people who have advanced degrees and who spent a fortune getting those degrees. So they are deeply in debt, and they're doing, you know, carrying a pretty heavy workload, you know, as postdocs, research, etc. And they were saying that the compensation that they're getting from many of them, they can't even afford, you know, like Seattle is a very expensive city, right?
Exactly.
Which is where you're based. So that they were saying that they're just struggling making ends meet.
Yep, absolutely. And I want to say also that the graduate student union, the local UAW 4121, recently conducted a study of graduate student employees at the university and found that an astonishing number of graduate student employees were rent burdened or extremely rent burdened. So that means that they're paying, you know, in excess of 40% of their income on rent. Because here in Seattle, you know, one of the most expensive cities in the country, rents are just going up and up and up. And, you know, as young workers who Some are facing student debt. Some are, many are international students and international employees. We need to work together to ensure that we can, you know, that we can do high quality research and we can, you know, be the best researchers and scientists and scholars that we can.
Yeah, I mean, those jobs are pretty stressful to begin with, you know, given the competition and the few positions that are opened and just the general expectations. And then there's the racism, the sexism, the homophobia that people face. And of course, for students who are immigrants, you know, now worrying about these immigration policies. But finally, I mean, the University of Washington does have this reputation for being so liberal. And I'm looking at a letter that they wrote about faculty unionization. And they're saying that we do not believe that abridging the gains we've made in and through shared governance at the democratically elected Senate, college, school, and department levels will serve the university and all its constituencies. And they're basically saying that they don't think that unionization will be helpful in their drive for excellence. So clearly there's an anti-unionization bias generally there. But I'm also looking at the clock, Max, and realize that I am out of time. But for people who want to find out more about this union drive and how they can support you all with your efforts to be part of UAW 4121, quickly, what should they do? Is there a website or someplace that they could go?
Yeah, absolutely. So you can check out our website at postdocunited.com.
Okay.
That will take you to our website, and we have a really great frequently asked questions section. We have a lot of resources for people who want to learn more about the campaign and kind of understand
Okay, well, on that note, Max, we are out of time, so I'm going to have to leave it there. I want to thank my daughter, Chanda Prescott Weinstein, who is at the University of Washington, for her help with today's show. Sojourner Truth will be back on the air tomorrow for our weekly roundtable. You won't want to miss that. I want to thank the entire Sojourner Truth team. This is your host, Margaret Prescott. Thank you for listening.